29. The Wreck. After Colette left to read in her room, Murdo spent part of the morning in the library, examining the books. He saw no further signs of Griff, but couldn't escape the feeling that invisible eyes were watching him. The lights outside the porthole were turned off. Obviously, they were travelling as stealthily as possible. Comrades strode through the library on the way to various destinations, but their faces, as always, were unreadable. He noted that most seemed to be European, but there were one or two Cubans, and for the first time he saw a Chinese comrade. Was there some underground movement drawing people from across the globe to Icaria? He added this to his list of things he would tell Mr. Socrates, if that day ever arrived. As the vibrations of the Actinio grew stronger, Murdo became more concerned. Was Colette correct about the ships hunting for victims? Occasionally, the Actinio turned in the water and Murdo would grab the reading table, bracing for impact. Were they circling back? He had no sense of the direction they were taking, nothing to mark his compass by. He found himself wanting to talk more with Colette, but she had made it clear she didn't want to watch the sinking of another ship. Murdo felt guilty about having lied to her, but it had been necessary. He didn't know any more if she was trustworthy, and it was frustrating how easily she could read him. He had studied how to play different roles all his life. Was his education failing him? Mrs. Finchley had taught him so much about acting. He'd spent most of his life pretending he was someone else. Perhaps, if he lived through all this, he would ask Mr. Socrates to send him to Mrs. Finchley for more lessons. After skimming through On the Origin of Species, Murdo felt a sudden fatigue and decided it would be best to save his energy. It had only been 2 days since he'd plunged into the freezing ocean, and so much had happened since then. Being exhausted wouldn't help his acting, that was for sure. He climbed the spiral staircase that cut through the bridge. Captain Montoriel didn't acknowledge him. She was so busy making notations in her log. Several comrades were working alongside her, adjusting levers and speaking through the voice tube to the crow's nest. He suddenly missed Serdar. Though the man spoke little, his presence had a calming effect on the crew and on the captain, even on Modo himself. What was Serdar doing in New Barcelona? There must be so many things to construct and plans to engineer when building an underwater city. Back in his room, Murdo first felt around to see if Griff was somewhere. Then he lay down on the cot, letting his features sag. Every muscle ached. He pulled the net mask over his face in case someone entered while he slept. Hours later, a klaxon sounded, and Murdo shot out of bed, clutching at the air. The light above him flashed a warning. He almost stumbled out of his cabin without shifting his features, but then he remembered to remove the mask and, with his back leaning against the door, stared into the small circular mirror. It was always harder to transform himself when he was sleepy. He pictured the night face. "Concentrate," he told himself, still seeing Mr. Socrates' judgmental glare. Modo gritted his teeth, feeling his features changing. His tongue grew smaller, smoother, and more able to curl around words than the tongue he'd been born with. When he was finished, he wiped the usual film of sweat from his forehead. The klaxons hurt his ears.
"Oh, so that's how that works," Griff said from a few feet away. "I nearly barked up my breakfast."
Murdo grimaced in annoyance.
"You're here."
"Obviously. Slipped in when your back was turned. I came to inform you that we're going to battle stations."
"I'm aware of that."
Modo slipped his net mask into his pocket. He didn't know where to look, and had the sense that Griff was everywhere. He wanted to hit him. Griff had stood there silently and watched Modo change his shape. It was a private act. No one, especially not someone as creepy as Griff, should see him do it.
"You seem pensive, old boy."
"Why are we going to battle stations?" Modo asked. "Some poor vessel has strayed into Captain Monturiel's imaginary Icarian boundaries."
"This woman must be stopped, Modo. Everyone is her enemy, believe me. But this will be a good chance for us to gather information and plan tactics. We may have an opportunity to strike."
"Strike?"
Modo scratched nervously at his arm.
"How would we operate the ship?
Don't panic. Old Griffey will look after you. We strike only if we're on the surface. You watch how she operates and who her sub-commanders are. Since Sir Dar's in the city, I wonder who's her second in command. They all look the same to me. I'm going to try to bypass the door into the aft chamber again. I want a good look at that engine. Toodaloo.
Modo felt himself being pushed aside. Then the door opened and closed. Modo glanced around the room. Was Griff really gone? And would he really attempt to take over the ship? If they were on the surface, they'd have to be right next to land or another vessel. Otherwise the comrades would capture them. Or rather, they'd capture Modo. No one would even see Griff. He shrugged. There was nothing he could do about it now. He opened the door. The klaxons were overpoweringly loud as he ran down the passage and the stairs onto the bridge. A female Ikarian immediately intercepted him.
"Mr. Walken, return to your room."
Without turning from her station, Captain Monturiel said,
"Mr. Walken can stay and observe how one defends a country. By now these trespassers should be well aware of our borders."
"But you've given them no warning," Modo said. She continued to stare out the periscope.
"They have had fair warning. The Icelanders no longer fish our waters, nor do the Finns, the Faroese, or the Irish. Anyone who now enters does so with the knowledge that they are trespassers. It's an act of war to cross into Ikaria's territory."
She twisted a brass knob, no doubt to magnify the outside world through her periscope. She spoke in Catalan, and a comrade at a bank of levers lifted two of them. Immediately, Modo felt the Ictinio rising. They must have been pushing water out of the ballast tanks. Modo went to the porthole. It was black outside the glass, though he thought he saw a glimmer of light on what might be the surface of the water.
"Objectio alla vista," Captain Monturiel said. "Abast vuitanta cinc metres. Centanta cinc metres. Sexanta cinc metres. Quaranta cinc metres."
Modo realized she was counting down the distance. He bit his lower lip and imagined the people on the other ship moving on the water, with no idea that this shark was charging toward them. His heart skipped a beat. What if Octavia was on that ship? Or Mr. Socrates? What if they were looking for him?
"Preparatio per l'impacte. Mr. Walken, brace yourself."
Modo grabbed a railing just before the Ictinio struck. The impact threw him forward. The logbook fell to the floor. The captain gave orders and the Ictinio reversed its engines, moving slowly backward.
"Diana,"
the captain announced. A small cheer rose from the Ikarians. Captain Monturiel adjusted another knob on the periscope, then turned and looked directly at Modo, her eyes gleaming in satisfaction.
"We have breached the hull of a fishing ship, slightly above the waterline, Mr. Walken. It will not sink, but the crew will limp back to port to warn others about these waters.
If your calculations had been off, you could have sent that ship to the bottom," Modo scolded. She stepped closer to him, her hand on her cutlass. His neck felt hot, and he searched his pocket for a handkerchief.
"Mr. Walken,"
her voice was a harsh whisper,
"soft men and women do not forge countries. That is what I learned from my father's death. Did his peaceful protestations get him any closer to the Ikaria he dreamed of? No. We must be hard. Every other country is out to undermine us. Being vigilant is the price we pay to keep our land safe. You are in Ikaria now, and you would do well to remember that."
"I will, Captain Monturiel," he replied. But his mind was on the Hugo. Monturiel had never apologized for almost killing him.